This is the Medic Cast, August 22nd, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to the program this week. A lot of good stuff coming up, including a very special segment coming up with Troy Smith. And Troy is an educator, paramedic from the West Coast, and I think he's out in Washington State now. Troy is one of the premier educators for capnography education and actually works very closely with Physio-Control. Disclaimer there, they are one of our sponsors. I actually work with them on occasion on some projects. But just because of that, I get to meet all these amazing educators and then bring some of them here on the show. And Troy contacted me recently and said, hey, I'd love to do a segment on capnography on your show and talk about its importance and why we need to be paying attention to capnography. So that's coming up later on in this episode. Also, we're going to have the news coming up, a couple of good news items this week that we need to really look at, and some other things. So in the meantime, I do want to remind you, get over to the MedicCast blog. That's mediccast.com/blog, and check out links to everything talked about in this and every other episode. You'll find a link for the show notes right at the top of the page, and I urge you to get in there and take a look at the information here. You know, Troy's going to talk about a brief overview on capnography today, and he's an amazing educator, but it doesn't take the place of you digging in and getting the information, internalizing it, applying it, looking at how you can use it in your scope of practice and within your protocols, and that's all entirely up to you. So make sure you're paying attention to that. Also, if you want to get back in touch with me, you can always leave a comment on that show notes page or any of the articles over on the MedicCast site, or you can shoot me an email. You can send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I love hearing from you. A lot of you have been sending me emails recently and contacting me, and it's great to hear from everybody. And when you send me those emails, I do get back in touch with you. I work very hard to do that, making sure that I get in touch with you. So if you haven't heard from me in a week or so after sending me an email, please send me another email. It must have gotten put out of my email box, or I accidentally deleted it, because I don't ignore people from the listener audience that send stuff to me. So please get in touch with me. You can send those in again to podmedic@mac.com. A lot of folks also contact me over on Twitter and Facebook. So if you'd like to do that, you can. Catch up with me over there under the handle podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic or facebook.com/podmedic. And don't forget, you can also catch me over on the Facebook fan page for the MedicCast at facebook.com/medicCast. We're going to go ahead and jump into a couple listener mail items here coming right up. We'll jump on into our listener email now. And I got an email a little while ago from listener Perry. I think she was checking in. I hope it's a she. Well, we'll see. If it's not, you get to call and give me the or email me and give me the email smack upside the head. But I think it's Perry, P-E-R-I, so I'll assume that's a woman checking in. She was checking in saying that she wanted to make sure that I mentioned that when I talk about things like poison control and really anything here on the show, that you really need to be aware of how these discussions work within your protocols. And, you know, it occurred to me I haven't really said that too often recently, and I should continue to make sure that it's in the forefront of your minds. Just because one area has an immediate direct contact with poison control via their medical direction and others don't, we need to make sure that we understand how we utilize the system in which we work. And that's different everywhere. Some protocols are more conservative than others. Some are more open than others. I know here in Maryland, we have a statewide protocol. And so in some aspects, that makes us very conservative with regard to some skills. But one of the things that I think Maryland does really well is they also have a statewide communications network system that allows us to bring other resources into a discussion like poison control. So there is access to poison control that we have directly from our radios in the back of our ambulance. We also can call in to the voicemail or to their number normally. And but one thing that I do want to make clear is we do not take orders from poison control. When we do bring them into the discussion, when we're giving a patient report, it is generally to cut out some of the middleman discussion. And one of the things that Perry pointed out was that in Virginia, and especially in her area of Virginia, she is not allowed to call poison control and for patient treatment information. She has to let the ER take care of that. One of the things that we're able to do, and one of the things I would urge you to find out if it's possible for you to do, is that by doing essentially a three-way conference call, which you can do with almost any cell phone nowadays, you can, while not taking direction from poison control, if the poison control representative has a question about an assessment aspect that you haven't shared in your report all up to that point, you can answer that question. And that's what we do in Maryland, is basically we bring the poison control online, they ask pertinent questions about the assessment, and then they give their recommendations to medical direction. And medical direction then passes on what can be done within our protocols to us. And then we concur, or we say that's still outside our protocol, or whatever the case may be. So we don't take direction for poison control either. I will, however, say this. There's nothing that precludes you as an individual professional in the medical careers to reaching out to your Poison Control Center for educational resources to get a question answered. You are a member of the public and certainly should avail yourself of the resources there. So while you may not be allowed to use it in the midst of a patient care situation, there's nothing that says you can't call and say, hey, you know, I ran into this, and just out of curiosity, is this really a problem? You know, whatever the case may be, a child ingested an entire box of crayons, you know, what is that really going to do to them? Utilizing this resource comes at all different levels, and it happens during the patient care process, definitely. But it also happens as part of your just general professional well-being and continuing education process, both officially and unofficially. So I would just, you know, keep that in mind. And Perry, thank you so much for taking the time to send that email in. You know, it is important for all of us to remember that no matter what we talk about here in the show, and the general information that I present here is just that, general information, you still need to take that back, utilize the resources I supply you, plus the resources you have, and determine what are you allowed to do, what are you not allowed to do with reference to what I talked about in your own patient care setting, and apply your own protocols, your own scope of practice. So thanks a lot, Perry, and thanks for reaching out. I also heard from several people on Facebook recently. We're coming up here just a week or so away from EMS World Expo in Las Vegas, and I'm so excited because so many people have reached out and said, hey, we're going to be there. Can't wait to come by the podcast studio booth in the exhibit hall and stop by and meet you and meet all the other podcasters and everyone else there. We're going to have a social media lounge set up adjacent to us, so if you have a Twitter account or a blog, or you'd like to get on your Facebook page, all you need to do is register in the social media lounge, and there'll be some couches there, places you can plug in and charge up your devices while you sit there and tweet about what you've seen at the expo, and sit there and talk about what you just saw in the podcast studio right next door. And you'll actually be able to listen to us because we're really literally adjacent to that booth, and we're helping to run that as well. And we want to thank Physio Control for sponsoring that space in the social media lounge. Because, you know, without their support, we couldn't make the internet available to you there. So you'll actually, once you register, you'll get a Wi-Fi password that you'll be able to use for the day to sit there while you're sitting in that booth. And you can write a blog post if you have a blog, or tweet, or put something up on your Facebook page. What have you seen? Post some pictures from the event. All of that's available to you, and we're happy to provide that social media space. And again, thanks to EMS World Expo and to Physio Control for helping to sponsor that space and enable us to do some training there and some education about social media from that space. So it's really going to be exciting. So I've heard from Renee and a bunch of others, and Troy Smith is going to be hanging out there. He's coming up later in the tip segment. So all that's going to be coming up real soon. Also, got an interesting message in, and I'm just kind of finding it here, coming up, from listener Kevin, checking in on duty to act, and wanted to know, you know, when do you have a duty to act? When you see something happening, if you're not on duty and you're like out at a sporting event, or you're out at the movies or whatever, And it just was an interesting question. And it comes back to, you know, that they gloss over all this stuff in the first module of EMT, the early stages of paramedic training, of the medical legal issues associated with EMS. What does it really mean? What do you have as a duty to act? I kind of break duty to act down into two things. There's the legal definition of duty to act, and there's the moral definition of duty to act. And I'm going to talk here specifically about the legal definition of duty to act. I think all of us get involved in EMS because we feel like we have a moral obligation to help people and we want to help people. But it doesn't mean that we legally are required to help people in every single situation. And so let's talk about that a little bit. Basically, a duty to act legally is really defined as, when are you required by law, by your protocols, by your job, to act and assist in the treatment of an emergency patient. Okay, and that's basically what is it. Generally, when you're off duty, there's a key word there, off duty, you generally, in most places, you're off duty. That may not always be the case. You can talk to people like police officers. There's a reason that most places require them to carry their weapon with them at all times, because a police officer is supposed to be ready to respond to a crime in progress, even when they may typically be off duty. And so does that mean they pull over speeders? No, not all the time. But if they see someone being reckless, they may take an effort to go ahead and stop and deal with that situation. And the same thing is true for us. So you need to know what your protocols tell you to do. You need to know what your medical director expects of you. And you need to understand when you have a duty to act officially and legally in your state, in your local jurisdiction. And so that's something you need to understand. And it should be laid out pretty carefully in your protocols and defined by your employer. There's another side of this, though. If you decide you have either a moral or a legal duty to act, once you start to act, you have a duty to remain in action, essentially. So no matter what your official duty to act is, once you begin to provide care for that patient, you have started care. You have decided you had a duty to act. And so once that decision has been made in the affirmative, you need to continue care according to your laws, your protocols, and what you're allowed to do in that particular situation. And for instance, in some places, you can work as a paramedic when you're at work, but when you're not at work, and you may be working for a volunteer transport organization, when you're not working, you become an EMTB. I know places around here in Pennsylvania that do that in the nearby state of Pennsylvania. They are paramedics, but when they step out of work and they may be working at their local volunteer ambulance service, they are BLS providers at that point. And so typically they drive because then they're not in the back and they don't have to worry about crossing any lines or doing anything wrong. So you need to understand how when you do respond outside of the workplace in a duty to act, what specifically are you allowed or supposed to do? And you may fall under things like Good Samaritan laws at that point and responding basically as basic responder. No one expects you to be carrying an intubation kit with you and expects you to be carrying a whole bag of drugs with you. So essentially your skills are going to be limited to BLS practices anyway. But really good question, Kevin, and I appreciate you taking the time to ask me that. And again, I would ask all of you, Kevin reached me on Facebook, Perry reached me by email. So however you want to catch up with me, you know, definitely do that. Take the time and opportunity to send in an email or reach me on Facebook or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is our voicemail line number. And I look forward to hearing from you or reading from you here soon. Let's jump on into this week's news. And the first item in the news is a problem occurring, a scandal occurring with the Baltimore City Fire Academy and their EMS program. And the chief has suspended the Fire Academy's EMS program until they can get some things resolved regarding a recent alleged cheating scandal, as well as some major paperwork issues. Now, the fire department's EMS programs were already on probation from the state EMS Coordination Office, the Maryland Institute for Emergency Medical Management Services, MIMS, and or Emergency Medical Services Systems, MIMS, and they were really trying to keep the system moving forward while they tried to alleviate the paperwork issues that they'd been having for the last year. But one of the things that you know, is most alarming to me is that this cheating scandal goes to the heart of some of the challenges that are being faced by trying to maintain EMS training, EMS continuing education, and the standard of care in fire services that are requiring their systems to have minimum EMS training as part of their training process. This may not even be for fire departments that have a primary transport program, but may be that they provide first response care as EMS providers from the engines that they respond on. In Baltimore, that's not the case. They actually are also the primary EMS response organization in the city of Baltimore. And one of these issues that is really alarming to me is I see this the recent problems that occurred in Massachusetts regarding recertification scandals for EMS among fire personnel, the challenges that are being faced in Baltimore City, the initiative about a year or so that was tried to be pushed forward by some members of volunteer fire associations in, I believe, Louisiana, where they tried to put forward that somebody who'd attained the level of EMT but was a firefighter did not have to recertify, did not have to go through any continuing education requirements anymore. And this is the alarming trend that I see here, is that fire-based EMS services just don't take EMS seriously. I know there's going to, you know, this is a broad brush. I'm stereotyping here. Send your emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I get it. You know, there are a lot of you out there in fire-based EMS services that are busting your butts, taking care of your patients very well indeed. But at the end of the day, by and large, when I talk to leadership in the fire services that have an EMS component, when I talk to the firefighters that are not immediately associated with that EMS component, they never speak well of the EMS side of their fire department. And I know from talking to many firefighters in Baltimore City department that it is considered a punishment to have to ride the ambulance when you're a firefighter there. They see it as this thing that they don't want to have to do. In that department, it is very well known that if you go and become a medic and ride the ambulance for a certain period of time, that once you've paid your dues on the ambulance, you never have to ride that ambulance again, which is a hell of a way to deal with the part of your service that is running the bulk of your calls. I see this again and again and again and again, and it points out to me overall why we need to get away from the public safety side of things and get EMS more closely associated with healthcare, because public safety, that response model, just does not gel well with the ongoing demands, the increasing demands of the EMS services. Now, again, I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, and there are some places out there that are doing amazing things in their services, but largely because they have a different culture and a management that supports that different culture that says we're going to support the EMS side of things because that's a primary aspect of our response. I think there's a lot of old school firefighters out there that think they're just about fighting fires. But, you know, the fire service has largely put themselves out of business with their fire safety messages and the push to change building codes and sprinkler systems and make places safer. Yeah, buildings still burn down, but you know, the amount of fires that are responded to are way down. The fires that are responded to are often contained safely. And it is not the same type of system it was. You look at systems that run both, and typically the EMS side of the fire services are running three times, four times, sometimes even five times the amount of calls that the fire service side of things runs. And they're working a lot harder to get the job done with often a lot less resources. So I really see this as just an indicator that we need to have a complete groundswell of change in how we approach EMS in these dual services, that we can't just continue to have EMS be a second-class citizen in the fire department. If you're going to have an EMS service associated with your fire department and they're running the bulk of the calls, and they should be getting the bulk of the recognition, in my mind. Again, you're welcome to complain and tell me I'm an idiot. And hey, I know I'm an idiot, but I think I'm right about this one. So, you know, please let me know if you think I'm nuts and send those emails in. You can send an email in. I will respond to you and I will probably share your email here on the air. So you can have your voice heard as well. I'm not the be-all, end-all of things, but I'm alarmed when I continue to see these types of scandals, these types of programs that are trying to sidestep the high-quality EMS education and the high-quality standards that are needed to maintain a professional healthcare organization. And that's the difference. So, again, I look forward to hearing from you. Interestingly enough, talking about an increase in numbers of calls and types of calls, an interesting article that I picked up coming out of an Australian affiliate of ABC looks at the increased amount of prescription drug abuse calls being seen by their ambulance service there. And this is focusing on Victorian Ambulance Service in Australia. And they said that while we're seeing a decrease in calls for things like public drunkenness, alcohol overdoses, and illegal drug overdoses, the numbers of calls for prescription drug abuse calls associated overdoses are on the rise, and it's an alarming situation. Now, a lot of times because these medications are more readily available, especially for younger individuals looking for a quick and easy way to get high. You know, grandma's OxyContin from her back surgery is sitting right there, or from her hip accident or whatever. You know, they go over to visit grandma and they go home with a pocket full of her OxyContin pills. This is an issue, and we need to really be aware of what's going on. We should have an idea, you, the individual provider, that's right, we, all of us, should have an idea of what's going on in your system. Talk to each other. Talk to your supervisors. Ask, like we talked about poison control earlier, ask poison control to come in and do an educational session with you, or send some materials for you to do an educational session for your coworkers on what are we seeing more of in this region? What's on the rise? What kind of medication should we be looking for? What are the common side effects and symptoms? It's one of the reasons I like having Lisa Booz here periodically on the MedicCast, because I want to make sure that she is sharing some of the ongoing trends that she's seeing as an active member of the Poison Center here in Maryland. And this is just another thing. We need to be aware, just like I talk about seasonally, what kind of incidents and accidents are you likely to see in your region based on the changing of the seasons? If you're a ski resort, guess what? You're going to see more ski-related accidents. If it gets colder in your region in the wintertime, you know, coming up, then you need to be more aware of cold-related injuries coming up and what to look for. The flu season is coming in here in the U.S. very soon. So what are we looking for in our respiratory patients as the flu season rolls in? So all these things are important. This is no different. What are the trends in illegal drug use and in prescription drug use and in overdose calls? So I hope you'll pay attention to these types of things and be more actively involved in your end. Finally, a call that I can only call a catastrophe, and I mean that a little tongue-in-cheek, because recently a couple called 999 in the UK to get an ambulance to save their five-year-old. Their five-year-old cat. The dispatchers weren't aware of this and sent a full emergency response team, including an ambulance and a paramedic supervisor and a chase vehicle, to respond to these people's house, thinking they were having a sick five-year-old and that this was a desperately ill child. And we all know the gut check you get when you have that pediatric call come in. We don't get that many of them for serious pediatric patients. And so you have a seriously ill five-year-old, you're really alarmed. And I love the one quote here that says that One paramedic says, I think the paramedics were probably relieved it wasn't a child when to start with, and then they were absolutely gobsmacked because it's a freaking cat. You know, talking about abuses of the system, I know people, you know, are passionate about their pets. I guess I'm not that kind of a pet guy, and that makes me a bad person to some people. But, you know, there is a difference between people and pets. And we cannot start getting down the path of, well, I treat my cat like it's one of my children, so I should be able to call emergency services to come take care of my cat. We can't go there. We can't handle the patient load we have. We don't need to add Fluffy to the picture. So I hope that you will look and see how we can better educate our public. I mean, this is a public education nightmare here. Basically, somebody didn't adequately educate the public about when it's appropriate to call 911 or 999 or whatever your emergency service number is. This is why you can't just sit there and bitch and moan about it when something like this happens. When you have a catastrophe in your system, why is it happening? It's happening because our public doesn't understand what we do, how we do it, and how they can better serve us so that we can better serve them. And these are the three parts of that picture. It is an educational failure. So this is an opportunity for them to start getting out there and telling people, this is what you need to do. These are the numbers you need to call. If you have an overdose, but it's non-emergent, call poison control first. If you have an emergency with your five-year-old cat, you need to go to the vet. I know you don't feel like you have to say that, but it's like parenting. You know, I say things to my kids that 20 years ago, I would have never thought come out of my mouth. But it seems like they find ways to get things coming out of me when I have to say things to somebody like, stop playing with your sister's head. You know, you shouldn't have to say that, but you do. And the same thing happens with patients. So let's look at this as a learning opportunity. And, you know, ultimately, they were back on the street very quickly. But they went on an emergency response to this situation and could have caused a motor vehicle accident, could have caused other problems, could have been taken away from another emergency. There are all a number of reasons why this is bad. But what are we going to do to fix it? We can complain about it, but we need to fix the problem. So let's get out there and educate our public about what we do. And then you won't have to go and treat Fluffy because she's got a stuck hairball. That's it for the news. Check out the links in the show notes. You can read this for yourself. This one article, at least, maybe print this one out and post it at your station. I think everybody will get a good laugh out of it. You can find those links in the show notes at medicast.com/blog, and you'll find all of that over there. And I urge you to check that out. And if you have a comment or a question or a suggestion about what to do when Fluffy comes to be called in your ambulance, you can let me know and leave a comment over there on the site. Time now to jump in, and we'll take a look at a tip of the week segment coming up here. We're going to be talking about capnography and some of the basics aspects of capnography, what it is, how it's handled. If you've been around for a while, you probably use capnography in a variety of different ways. Maybe you use it to its fullest potential, and you'll be right on board here with Troy Smith and I, or maybe it's something that you're just getting used to using, and you'd like to know more about it. This isn't going to take the place of a real education session that you need to have some long-term ongoing education and use, but at least it'll get you started down the path of what you need to think about and how to better utilize this tool. And I'm really happy Troy Smith was able to catch up with me. He's a paramedic from Washington State and an educator that works with a lot of different organizations and companies out there. I know him through my relationship with Physio-Control and met him at one of their training sessions. They have an education center at every conference they go to for the major conferences, for EMS, for nursing, whatever. And Troy goes to a lot of the EMS conferences with them. And so if you get an opportunity, you can go in and get a half hour of continuing education for free in the exhibit hall from Physio-Control with people like Troy. And it's a great opportunity to pick up on some good information. So anyway, I want to point out that to you, that tool is there, and let you know that, but also to get into our segment here. So without too much further ado, let's jump into part one of our segment with Troy Smith on capnography, and then we'll catch up with the second half of it next week in that episode. Troy, tell us a little bit about your background as a paramedic and also what brought you to be so passionate about training and educating people about capnography.
Well, this is my 20th year in EMS, 17 now as a paramedic. Back in 1998, I was working for Santa Fe County Fire Department in New Mexico, and Dr. Brute Krause came out and introduced me to capnography. At that time, it sparked an interest in me that I realized this was a tool that I could use in many different types of patients, and a tool that would allow me to recognize changes in patient condition earlier than anything else I had on my rig. It's a tool, you know, and when I went out, go out and start using it and talk to people about it, no one really knew what it could do. And that's really what drove me to start wanting to educate on it, to learn about it, first of all, so that I could understand what I was seeing, and then go out and spread that word so that other people could use that tool. Like I said, in my opinion, it's one of the better ones that we have on our rigs. Use that tool to treat their patients and understand what's going on.
You know, I heard an interview recently with Bob Page, who is just an excellent 12-lead educator, and he made the comment that he thinks capnography is one of the most exciting tools to come into the back of an ambulance in the last 50 years, and yet no one pays much attention to it.
Yeah, that's very true. There's so many little nuances in capnography that if you don't use it and start to understand it, you're going to see patients that you say, wow, I don't understand why this happened. And then you have to have the resources, the tools to go back and understand the physiology about what's going on and why capnography was showing you what it was showing. I can't count the number of times that I knew something was wrong. The capnography was telling me something wasn't going right. The patient wasn't doing what I was expecting. And I never could figure it out at the time. But when I would go back and learn the physiology behind what I was seeing, then it made complete sense to me. But even though I didn't know what was going on, I knew something was happening. That was the key.
So let's talk a little bit about why we should be using capnography. And really specifically, what are we talking about when we talk about end-tidal CO2?
Well, the first thing that we talk about when we talk about and understand capnography is we always hear people using it to confirm ET tube placement. I travel all around teaching about capnography, and one of the things that seems to be pretty consistent is that most medics intubate anywhere from 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 times per year, so about one a month. What I always talk to people about is if we only use capnography to just do those ET tube placements, and now we're seeing something 10 times a year, how proficient are you really at understanding what's happening? If you only looked at 10, 12 leads a year, how good would you be at picking up those 12 lead changes? The answer is not very good, and that's true with capnography as well. So when we start talking about using capnography, the first thing we have to do is to use it, and to use it a lot, so that we understand what normal looks like, so that we can understand then abnormal. Capnography is a normal process that happens during metabolism. We use energy. We use oxygen combined with sugar to create energy, and a byproduct of that is CO2. Blood goes around and around. Air goes in and out. As long as those two things happen, we will have end tidal that we can measure at the mouth or the nose or the hub of the ET tube. The bottom line about what capnography does and measures is it's an indicator of the patient's perfusion, their ventilatory, and their metabolic statuses. So when we see changes of capnography, we can trace those back to one, two, or all three of those things. That is the most important thing to understand when we talk about capnography, is any change in capnography can be traced back to either metabolism, perfusion, or ventilation.
So let's talk about a little bit about the specifics in each of those categories. If you were looking at a patient's ventilation, let's start there, because obviously if you're not ventilating the patient, there's no way to read anything at the end tidal side of things. So let's talk about the difference between what's going on with the vascular and arterial CO2 levels versus what you're seeing at the end tidal CO2 levels. Is there a direct correlation, or do we lose something along the way?
Well, that's the nice part about NTIDAL, is contrary to pulse oximetry, where there can be huge differences between what your pulse oximetry level is and what your true PaO2 is. And we're seeing now lots of studies coming out saying, hey, we don't want to keep these patients that, you know, high 100% non-rebreathers at 100% O2 sats, because we really don't know what those PaO2s are. That's not true when we talk about capnography. In the normal function of the body, the A to A gradient is what really makes this thing work. The A to A gradient is the arterial to alveolar gradient that separates from the alveoli and the artery. It's very permeable to CO2. CO2 loves it, can cross very easily back and forth. So minus the little bit of dead air space that we have, when we say we have an end tidal of 35, within about a 2 to 5 difference, we're going to have the same PCO2. So we truly are talking apples to apples in this type of situation. You roll into the ED and you say, hey, they have an end tidal of 40. They draw lab values. They're going to have an end tidal, or they're going to have a PCO2 somewhere around 40. If there are differences in those two numbers, it's actually clinically significant, because we're having a change of that A to A gradient, and those are things that we need to investigate. It could be a mechanical issue, such as in a PE, or it could be some bronchospastic issues as well. But that is clinically significant for the docs then to start zeroing in on why those two numbers are different.
What about the ways we sample that at the end tidal point? You know, obviously, you can be attaching a sensor to an ET tube. You can have those nasal cannula sensors. Do they all really approximate the same types of values, or are there different technologies out there that are going to give you a different advantage to reading?
There are some different technologies out there. I am most familiar with the MicroStream technology, and that's found in both the Philips and the physio control monitors. There are some other monitors as well, but those are the two main pre-hospital monitors that we're going to see that MicroStream technology in. The benefits of the MicroStream technology is it's really a low flow, 50 mils per minute side stream capnography. And I guess to back up, I need to explain that there are two types of capnography, mainstream and side stream. Mainstream capnography measures it through the infrared light right in the source, right through the ET tube, the connector that you put on. The challenges for mainstream capnography for us in the pre-hospital field is that there were some calibration issues. The cables that actually had the sensor on them were very expensive. When I first came back to Washington State, that's what we had, was a mainstream capnography. It was actually just a capnometer. It gave us just a number, which if you only have that, it's like having a 12 lead that just tells you a number. You're really missing the big picture with that. So that's what we had. And those cables were around $2,000 a cable. And it didn't take a few of our guys cutting them on accident before our department said, hey, this is getting a little expensive.
You know, the equipment in the back of our units needs to be paramedic proof.
Yeah, and not expensive. That's the other big issue.
That's right.
It's going to get broke. I've always heard that joke, you know, you put a fireman in a room or a paramedic in a room, give them 2 rocks, you'll come back a little bit later, they're going to have 6 rocks sitting there. No one knows how it happens, but it happens. So, you know, when that's what we have. The MicroStream technology then has what I call it the, just a filter line. The actual technical term is the smart capno line. But they have, it's the ability to read and deliver read CO2 and deliver oxygen through the same device. It doesn't actually do it through the nasal prongs. The nasal prongs where it pulls CO2 from the read. Oxygen is actually delivered from little holes that are in the base of that unit right there. So it kind of creates this pillow or a cushion of hyperoxygenated air. And as the patient breathes in, they breathe in that amount. It's the same FDA approved, 2 liters in that versus the same as 2 liters in nasal cannula. The big difference that people don't always understand is that there's no oxygen that gets delivered through that nasal prong. Both those nasal prongs pull CO2. So if you have a deviated septum or you have someone that's through trauma isn't pushing air through both nares evenly, you're going to be able to pick that up. It also has a big duct bill at the bottom that can read CO2 as they breathe through their mouth. There's a little unijunction there, so as they breathe from the nose to the mouth, it'll switch pulling from either the nares or from that duct bill specifically. So it's easy to use. You just plug it in. There's no calibration issue. You plug it in, you're off, you're running. And then they also have the ET hub that we use most commonly, when we're talking about bag valve mask ventilation, or when we're talking about just general ET tube verification. It is important to know, and it's always been frustrating for me as well. And I know that in talking with Iridian, they are trying to develop a non-rebreather mask solution. Right now, you have to put on the nasal prongs and then put the non-rebreather over the top of it. And they're trying to develop an integrated system into that. So instead of having to use two different devices, you can just use the one.
Now the two devices do work when they work you can use them together. It's just it would be more elegant to have a single solution.
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing to actually of note when we talk about using a bag valve mask, or we start talking about using CPAP, etc. Most of those devices, you can, well, actually all of them that I've ever seen, you can use that ET hub device from the filter line sets to plug in between those two systems, but you actually get a little bit of a washout the farther you get away from the source. So while you can put a BVM on and put the ET hub for capnography and then put your BVM on and measure end tidal, you're actually going to get a little lower reading than what's truly there. So it's better to put the nasal cannula on, put the non-rebreather mask right over the top of it, or your CPAP mask right over the top of it, and measure it that way than with the hub. The hub should really only be used for your truly intubated patients.
Good to know. Now, you talked a little bit about just having a number versus having a waveform associated with that number, and compared it to getting an EKG where they just hand you a couple of numbers, and rather than being able to actually see the waveform. And I like that because I think it's one of the things we're very visual in assessment. It's part of, I think, what makes us humans is we are very visually oriented. And being able to see that waveform can tell you a lot. So it's not just knowing, hey, I've got a patient who's not perfusing well, or I have a patient that's hypercarbic, their numbers are high. It's not just a number. We can also see what's going on with their ventilations.
Yeah, an end tidal waveform is just as diagnostic as a 12-lead EKG. I'll say that again because most people don't believe me or don't understand that. It is just as diagnostic as a 12-lead EKG. So if you're doing capnography or if you're going to do end tidal measurements of CO2, if you're not using a waveform monitor, you're really missing the point. And like I said, I can give you an EKG with just a heart rate of 70. It could be a STEMI, it could be a secondary block, it could be many different types of things, and all you know is the rate 70. Same is true for end tidal capnography. Just because you have a number of 40 does not mean that this patient is normal. Without looking at the waveform, all you know is that they're producing an end tidal of 40. You don't really know if there's anything going on. And asthma is a primary example of that. When you look at that waveform, it will tell you it's abnormal, but their numbers very well may be within that normal range.
And that's one of the advantages of when you have to move away from that, it's just a tube checking device. So we're going to get away from just using that hub that attaches to our ET tube and allows us to ventilate the patient past the device. But it also, we need to start really using all of the tools, and that includes using the nasal prongs and getting used to reading the other aspects of capnography and using it on the patients that we aren't intubating, the asthmatic patients, the person who's hyperventilating, all these patients that have a respiratory issue. You can see a lot about what's going on with these patients.
Yeah, like I said, when I go out and teach, I tell people, I say, hey, look, for the next 30 days, put this on every patient you see. Start to understand what's normal so that when you see abnormal, you at least recognize it, and then we can start dealing with why it's abnormal from there if you didn't remember from the class or I didn't cover it in class. And then I tell them, look, after 30 days, you're going to realize you don't need to put it on every patient. But certainly in my care, I put it on every patient that has a shortness of breath or some type of respiratory component. I put it on every patient that I give narcotics to, because we're giving you narcotics is one that look, I'll be honest with you. You know, this is what I hear. Hey, my medics will pay attention. They're in the back. Look, I've been in the back. I know how things get. I'm trying to do my chart. I'm getting ready to turn over the patient to the hospital. I'm not always directly, immediately paying attention to the patient that's sitting right there. If I've got a general run-of-the-mill person, maybe it's a little old lady with a hip fracture that I've given pain medications to, and I'm sitting back in the back of the rig while we're going to the hospital, I'm doing my chart, I'm getting things ready, I'm not always exactly looking to see what her respiratory effort is. And with capnography, the nice thing about capnography is it will tell me as soon as that patient starts hypoventilating. And if they quit breathing, heaven forbid, I'm going to know immediately when that last breath happens. About 30 seconds later, if I wasn't paying attention, alarms are going to start going off and telling me, hey, you need to pay attention. With pulse oximetry, I remember one of the first things I learned when I was going through paramedic school at Central Washington University was that we went into the OR and they told us, the anesthesiologist said, Troy, you have time. Watch this. Watch this patient. He would paralyze them and he wouldn't ventilate them. And he would make me watch the pulse oximetry. And it would be 99 or 100% for a minute, for 2 minutes. There's actually a study that was done that looked at the oxygen desaturation curve specific to patients that they intubated, you know, paralyzed and intubated. And the average person, which was a 70-kilogram adult, the normal 70-kilogram adult in this study, it took 8 minutes for that pulse oximetry to drop to 90%. Their worst-case scenario was the obese 127-kilogram adult that started at 99%, and it still took 2.5 minutes. So the question I ask people, if that's you laying there and you quit breathing, would you like someone to know within 30 seconds, or would you like someone to know within 2.5 minutes that there's a problem? We're seeing now capnography being put into PCA pumps on the hospital floors, because certainly those nurses are working one nurse to 4, 6, 8, 10 patients, maybe, depending on the hospital. They're not in those rooms all the time.
No, they're not.
So with these patients and their self-PCA pumps, they have had multiple cases of over-medication, respiratory arrest, and in some cases, death. Well, we're seeing this being put into place that if their end tidal and respiratory rate are not within a certain range, that PCA pump will not deliver more medication.
And for the people listening that may not know, PCA pump is that patient-controlled anesthesia or analgesia device.
Yeah.
Let somebody control their own morphine administration. And it won't – typically it's supposed to be set so that they can't overdose themselves. But it doesn't – it's set to a general parameter and everybody's different. And that's going to wrap up this Tip of the Week segment. This is part one of this section on capnography with Troy Smith. And we'll catch up with him and talk about some more in-depth applications and uses for capnography. And also, more importantly, why it matters to you, the EMS professional, that you should be using this tool more frequently than you probably already are. So we'll catch up with that segment, part two, next week here on the MedicCast. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the program this week. And again, special thanks to Troy Smith for helping out and coming by and talking about capnography. And we'll have the part two of that segment next week in that episode. I also want to remind everybody that we're going to be at EMS World Expo. If you're listening to this and you're anywhere near Las Vegas next week, the 29th through the 2nd of September, August 29th through September 2nd, that full week there, EMS World Expo is happening in Las Vegas. They're going to have a mass casualty training event going on in the parking lot outside of the convention center. They've got the convention center full of everything you could possibly think of associated with EMS, as well as some other information and exhibits for fire and police as well. It's just a huge event. We're going to be there with the podcast studio. I think we're doing 12 or 13 full episodes from the exhibit hall floor live whenever the exhibit hall is open. So you want to come by our booth. It's going to be right there in the program. You can check it out. Come by the podcast studio. Hang out in the adjacent social media lounge where you can tweet, leave a Facebook post about what you're up to, sit and relax, charge up your devices while you're there, and charge up yourself with some cool fellowship with other EMS professionals, as well as other people and podcasters that you might want to take a look at and get a chance to meet. So if you're going to be there, come up and say hi. Don't be shy. Come up, shake my hand. I really want to meet each and every one of you. I want to hear about what you're doing. I want to know what you're passionate about so I can put that in the show coming up. So you're part of this process. You are part of the MedicCast community, and I want to continue to support that. If you want to find out anything we talked about in this episode, medicast.com/blog is where you can find that. Links to everything we talk about. There'll be I'll be posting a schedule of the shows that are going to be done at the podcast studio, so you can check that out. Know when the MedicCast is going on, the EMS Garage, Gen Med Show, EMS Leadership. Greg Fries is going to be there for the EMS Educast. Just a ton of people. All that will be posted over there, as well as the show notes for this episode. And you can follow up on the links on capnography, links on the information in the news. All of that available there. If you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email, podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me over on Twitter and Facebook, and that's under the handle podmedic. So twitter.com/podmedic, facebook.com/podmedic. And if you haven't already done so, follow us over on Facebook on the Facebook fan page, and that's facebook.com/mediccast. That's it. We're going to go ahead and close out the show. And again, I'm looking forward to seeing each and every one of you over at EMS World Expo. If you are going to be there, make sure you come by the podcast studio, hang out. We got chairs there. You're not going to interrupt anything. Just walk in, sit down, you know, grab a bite to eat at the food court, and then come back and sit down and catch part of your favorite podcast while you're there. And that's what it's there for. We want you to come in and sit down. We want you to come in and hang out. We want you to meet us and just see what's going on. And heck, you can bring your best friend with you and show him what some of the great shows here at the MedicCast and at the ProMed Network are all about. So, and without further ado, I will see you all real soon, hopefully, over at EMS World Expo. In the meantime, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, back again soon with another episode here of the MedicCast. And you should remember, though, the most important thing, scene safety, BSI.